Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company and streaming on the web at KSFR. We are podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking about the production called A Light in My Soul, Una Luz en Mi Alma, which is a play about conversos, or crypto Jews. I'm very happy now to welcome Anne Hillerman. She is the author of the new book, Tony Hillerman's Landscape, On the Road with Chi and Leaphorn, which she did the text for and her husband, Don Strell, did the beautiful photographs for. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
It's wonderful to have you back. And the two of you will be at a reception and book signing at the Santa Fe Community Convention Center on Sunday, the 8th of November, from 4 to 6 in the afternoon. And it's an event sponsored by the Friends of the Santa Fe Public Library.
Yeah, and Don and I, in connection with our book, Don has put together a beautiful, I would call it a slideshow, but it's actually more than that. It's pictures from our book and then some family photos, pictures of all of Dad's book covers, sort of a, I guess a collage, a visual collage of some of the sites that really inspired him. And I've done a script to go with that that talks about the forces that shaped him as a writer. And then also talks about some of the adventures that Don and I had when we were putting Tony Hillerman's Landscape, our new book, together. So anyway, people get more than, it's not just Don and me signing books, it's a whole big package of fun.
Now, it's interesting that you started this book while your father was still alive. He passed away about a year ago or so.
Yeah, that's right.
And he said something in his introduction, which I found so interesting, which is he was very interested in the Navajo culture. And, of course, his detectives and his mysteries are Navajo people. And there's a lot of intercultural conversation and conflict going on. And when you're doing a book of photographs, how can you capture any of that in a photograph?
You just do the best you can do. And this, how can you capture mystery in a photograph?
You can't. And so you're doing something else.
Yeah. Well, the book has quotes from Dad's books. Don and I started on this project about 3 years ago. And I started by rereading all of the novels and making notes where I came across those really luscious descriptions of scenery. And then Don and I looked at a map, and we could have spent, every day for probably 6 months driving. Some of these were very remote places, and some of them I discovered were sort of composite sites, sites that Dad had put together from his knowledge of Indian country, but also from his imagination and from his skill as a writer, kind of knowing what kind of setting he needed to frame the mystery. So anyway, we did all of that, and matching the quotes where Chi or Leaphorn, you know, they're driving in the car and the sun is setting and it's so gorgeous they just have to pull over and watch it. Matching quotes like that with actual pictures of landscape where theoretically that sunset would have been was really an interesting process. And sometimes we hit it right on. And sometimes, because 30 years had gone by since Dad had written those books, there were power lines, there were more roads and more dust and more pollution, or we hit it on just one of those slate gray days that are rare, but when they happen, they're not the best for photographs. So the whole thing was a real juggling act, but it was a very interesting process. And I have to say, you can't do, just like a movie can't be a book, our book, which was designed to be basically a photo tour of Tony Hillerman's landscape, couldn't capture a lot of the cultural innuendo, the Navajo spirituality, the stuff that Dad's novels do so well. You know, we did what we could do within the limits that were set for us. And I really am happy with this book. I think a lot of it is just spot on.
And it's a beautiful book to look at. And it does make you wonder and go along on this journey with you and also with your father, Tony Hillerman. What took him out there, both in the first place, but then as he became an established author and became known by mystery readers and by Navajo people in these areas that he wrote about, did he go out there specifically to do research, to look at locations, to visit?
Yeah, all of the above. When he was first writing, he spent a lot of time exploring the Navajo Reservation, I think partly looking for sites and partly because he was by nature just curious about the world. And he had grown up in a small town in rural Oklahoma, so he has had always a great affinity for people who live in isolation and people who live off the land and people who are kind of bound together by the adversity of life in harsh conditions. Then after he'd been in New Mexico, I don't know, 20 or 30 years, he knew the reservation pretty well, but he still would go, if he was working on a book and he came across a slick spot, something where he wasn't quite sure maybe where the story was going, or he'd written himself into a little box and, you know, there he was trying to figure out what to do. Often he would just get in his truck and drag my mom along with him, although she was always very happy to go. And they would just go away for the weekend and drive to Shiprock or Crown Point or Window Rock and just soak up that landscape again. And he said it never failed to release whatever the bond was that was keeping his creative inspiration from flowing.
I knew a writer once who said that writer's block is always lack of information.
Yeah, I think that might be right. Dad often said that he thought it was just laziness. But I have to say, on his part, it wasn't laziness. I mean, he really approached writing with strong discipline. But I think, yeah, sometimes it is just lack of information, or it's not maybe forgetting exactly what it was that you wanted to say 300 words ago. You know, you need to kind of just recharge your batteries. And that was certainly what Indian Country did for Dad.
Looking at a book like the one that you wrote, Tony Hillerman's Landscape, On the Road with Chi and Leaphorn, on the road, it's really as much as anything a road trip for you and your husband, Don Strell. Did you get to really get off the road and into the landscapes, into the land, walking away from maybe the parts that have changed the most, where there are the power lines or the new buildings or whatever?
Yeah, we did. Shiprock was one of the sites that appears in many, many of Dad's books. So we wanted to make sure that of all the photos we had of Shiprock would really be outstanding, which meant Don and I spent a lot of time waiting for the right light, waiting for the right weather. And so we pulled off on little roads and basically just sat there watching, and it was fabulous. You know, we'd get out of the car and walk around. We probably were trespassing on somebody's grazing land, but nobody ever gave us a hard time. One time we were there waiting, and these two reservation dogs came up, and they were really cute. They were, I guess, maybe just barely over puppyhood. They were watching us. They were sitting at a respectful distance, and then I think they could smell the French fries left over from our lunch, so they slowly crept closer as we didn't threaten them. Finally, they were right by the car door, and we fed them French fries. They were our new best friends. Yeah, but we did get off the road. We spent about a week at the Grand Canyon because, as people who've read my dad's books probably know, one of his last books, Skeleton Man, has many scenes that are set in the Grand Canyon. And so we thought, also there are so many gajillion photos of the Grand Canyon. We wanted something that wouldn't just look like a cliche. So we spent a lot of time there walking on the trails and talking to people, and it was great. I mean, what a wonderful, wonderful writing assignment to be able to be in this beautiful landscape and also to have been inspired in the first place by my dad's lovely descriptions of it.
I was thinking when I was looking at this beautiful book, and I've learned a little bit about your father and his personality through this and through the event that happened recently at the Lenzik, which was an honoring of Tony Hillerman and his work. He seemed like a really good man, a kind person, a family man, a religious person who took his ethics into the community and so on. And yet he wrote these books full of death and violence and all these horrible things. And I can't help but wonder where that comes from in somebody who's just such a nice person.
Interesting, isn't it? Yeah. I think some of it, I think all of us are interested in the dark side. But some of the details were ideas that came to Dad, I think, while he was working as a journalist. For his first 25 years, he was a newspaper reporter and then editor at the Santa Fe New Mexican. And as part of that, he covered a lot of crime, you know, lots of corruption. He interviewed a man who was on death row shortly before his execution. And the man was repentant. But the main reason he wanted the interview was that his mother had basically abandoned him as a toddler. And he was hoping that his mother would see this story and then come and claim his body after he was executed. And that story stuck with Dad forever. And he eventually was able to incorporate it in one of his novels. I think he always had a very strong curiosity about people and what made them tick. And of course, part of what makes us tick is the constant conflict. You know, should we do the right thing or should we do the easy thing? You know, should we do what's expedient or should we do what's moral? And my dad really loved exploring those questions, and he talks about them a lot, sort of surreptitiously, but they're, I think, one of the threads that run through most of his novels.
One of the things that he said that I think you quote him saying in this book is that the Navajo people are the most ethical people he's ever known. What is it about their way of life and not so much beliefs, but the way they take their ways into the community and the way they live that really inspired him to say that?
One thing he always appreciated about the Navajo people that he met, and of course, this sounds like a cliche, you know, people are people. There's good people, bad people, you know, but in general, he met many Navajo people for whom their spiritual life was totally part of their daily life. There wasn't any separation, you know, as in some, you know, other religions, you know, I can do what I want and then I'll just go to church or I'll go to confession and everything will be okay. And I think he really appreciated that it wasn't, there wasn't a separation between daily life and the spiritual life. He appreciated the lack of interest in revenge and the fact that people, the understanding that everybody can make mistakes and our job is really to forgive each other and embrace each other. I mean, not to be stupidly taken advantage of, but to sort of welcome each other with open hearts and suspend judgment. He also appreciated the way that Navajo life and the sacred Navajo lands were interwoven. You know, that so much of that beautiful landscape also comes with Navajo creation stories. And usually those stories have something to say about human foibles and, well, kind of like Christian forgiveness stories. People make mistakes, people are forgiven, people start over. And in Navajo cosmology, I guess like a lot of the Greek cosmology, the gods make mistakes too. You know, but we all are kind of struggling along in this world, doing the best we can.
The lack of revenge, having a cultural ideology which really doesn't emphasize revenge, that sets up all sorts of possibilities for cultural conflict in the midst of an American society that seems hell-bent on revenge at every possible turn.
And Dad used that in several of his novels. That's, in fact, how his detectives figure out that whoever committed the crime either was a non-Navajo or was a Navajo who had probably been raised off the reservation and had fallen out of the way of harmony.
It must have been interesting for you to have reread all of those novels. I mean, even the most avid Tony Hillerman fans read them over years, not in one big chunk.
It was. Actually, it was great fun. When I had the idea for this book, I started with Blessing Way and read them all through chronologically. And I was really surprised and pleased at how well those early novels held up. You know, most people, the first novels, well, I guess the first novel you work on for, you know, a gajillion years because you're trying to get published. And then after that, usually the second novel is a little weaker because you have a two-book contract and then things kind of move along. But really those early books I thought were great, and a lot of them have really very profound insights, I thought, into the difference between white culture and Navajo culture. It seemed to me as Dad moved on, the book, there was more, kind of more action in them, You know, whereas the earlier ones, I guess, reflected all the time he'd spent at Zimmerman Library doing research and all the, you know, gajillions of conversations he'd had with Navajo students who he taught at UNM and Navajo faculty people and then their relatives and all of that. But it really was a wonderful pleasure to reread all of those. And then some of them I read several times because after Don and I did our initial foray into Indian country looking for sites, then I realized so many of Dad's books had Shiprock, Gallup, Window Rock. You know, Window Rock is the home of the Navajo Nation and the headquarters of the Navajo Police Department. So that site is in almost every book. But in our book, we had to just find one book to put it in because we didn't want people to see 50 pictures of Window Rock.
Right.
Yeah. So then I read them all again, looking for other sites. And it was fascinating. I have to say, I really, every time I read them, I got a little something out of them. And I don't think I'm just saying this because I'm Tony's daughter.
Right.
I think really any reader probably, the first time I read a mystery, I'm usually just reading for story. You know, a good mystery, you want to find out what happens. So sometimes even I would skip some of those descriptions because I want to know, you know, does he live or die?
Right.
Who did it?
I know. I mean, I've read mysteries where I had to just get up for air because it was so scary. You just
right.
have to stop and fan yourself off and take some deep breaths.
Right, right. Go get a Coke.
But meanwhile, you skip it. So then the second time you read it, and especially if you're thinking about doing a book like this about landscapes, you're really honing in on those descriptive passages.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was exactly right. And that was a lot of fun. It was nice to kind of, you know, catch my breath and not already knowing what would happen, be able to just sort of savor the experience of reading them.
We're talking to Ann Hillerman. Her new book is Tony Hillerman's Landscape, On the Road with Chi and Leaphorn. Now, Chi and Leaphorn are the two of the detectives, Navajo people. Can you tell us a little bit about each of them for those who have not yet picked up a Tony Hillerman book?
Well, I'd be delighted to. Joe Leaphorn was Dad's original detective. He introduces him in The Blessing Way. And he was originally designed as a supporting character. When Dad submitted the manuscript of The Blessing Way, the main guy is a white anthropologist who is doing research on Navajo witchcraft. And he and Leaphorn went to school together, so he calls Leaphorn in because, you know, there's police stuff involved. But basically, this white guy was the main detective. So Dad submitted this manuscript to his agent, and his agent did not like it. And she, in a legendary story, encouraged him to, if he was hell-bent on publishing it, to get rid of the Indian stuff.
Oh, my goodness.
Luckily, Dad had read in Publishers Weekly that Harper & Row had a new editor named Joan Kahn who was looking for a different kind of mystery that had to do with indigenous people. So Dad sent her like a 2-paragraph letter saying, I've got this manuscript. It has an Indian detective. My agent says I should get rid of him. Would you be willing to take a look and see what you think? And Joan Kahn sent him back an even shorter letter which said, send it on. So Dad sent it to Joan Kahn, and she not only did she like it, but she said, I think this guy Leaphorn needs to have more to do. He's a really interesting character, and you need to give him, you know, emphasize him more. So Dad did, and the book came out, and then he wrote Dance Hall of the Dead was the second Joe Leaphorn book, and that book takes Leaphorn to Zuni Pueblo. Then he wrote another Joe Leaphorn book, and then the name of which escapes me at the moment. And then the movie people were interested. So they talked Dad's agent into signing over the rights to Joe Leaphorn while they figured out what to do with, you know, scripts and yada, yada, yadas. Well, Dad said in the meantime he was thinking he needed a different detective. He needed somebody younger, somebody a little more savvy about Navajo tradition. He had introduced Leaphorn as kind of a cynical, older, more acculturated Navajo. So then he came up with Jim Chi. And the first novel with Jim Chi, I believe, is People of Darkness that has to do with uranium poisoning. It's a really, really interesting book. So he wrote 2 more books with Jim Chi by himself. And then he was at a book signing, and a woman at the book signing came up to him and said, gee, I really love your books, but I've been wondering why you've changed the name of your detective. And Dad said his heart just fell. He thought, oh, no, I obviously have not done this right if readers can't even tell the difference between these two guys.
Right.
So that was when he decided that he should put them together in a book so people could see that they were really different people.
Now, do you think that she was not a very close reader? Like, when you read that and you see Jim Chi and compare him to the earlier books with Leaphorn, do they seem like different people to you?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think she was a close reader, but I think she did all of us a really big favor.
Right.
Because when Dad put them together, that was about the time that Rupert Murdoch took over HarperCollins. And he was looking for, they decided there were maybe some of these regional writers like Dad, who if they spent a little more money promoting them and encouraged them to write longer books with a few more subplots, maybe they would be able to make it as national writers. So about the time that was happening, Dad wrote Skinwalkers, which was the first book that has those detectives together. And Skinwalkers won a lot of prizes and sold more copies than any of Dad's books had up to that point. So that put him on the radar at HarperCollins. And then they said, well, why don't you now write what they call a breakthrough book, which was Thief of Time. They said, you know, spend longer on it, put in more chapters, put in more details, you know, come up with more subplots. So Dad did, and they sent Dad on a national book tour, which was the first time they'd ever done that, and advertised it in the New York Times, and that was the first of his books to be on the New York Times bestseller list.
Very interesting.
Yeah. And part of what makes Thief of Time and Skinwalkers interesting is the conflict between those two detectives.
So how are they different? What are their personalities like?
Well, Leaphorn is very analytical, very thoughtful, very methodical, kind of the Sherlock Holmes without the drug problem sort of detective. Jim Chee is more spontaneous. He is conflicted because he really wants to be a Navajo singer. And how can he do that and still be a policeman? So a lot of times he kind of takes the law into his own hands. You know, if he sees, he, I think more clearly than Leaphorn, often sees the conflict between what's legal and what's just. And sometimes he won't act like a traditional policeman, partly because of his strong Navajo values and partly because of his kind of good-hearted human nature. You know, he can see that sending this guy to jail isn't going to do any good, whereas if you leave him out of jail so he can take care of his family and make restitution to the victims he hurt, things will work out a lot better.
Now, is restitution part of traditional Navajo culture?
Well, yes. Yes. There, I can't right offhand remember what book it was, but it's a book where there's a hit-and-run accident. And so Chi is trying to find the guy, and somebody's killed. And Chi's trying to find the guy who was responsible for that accident. And eventually he tracks him down. It turns out this guy is caring for his Downs. He's a grandfather. The rest of his family isn't around, but he's caring for his Down syndrome grandson by himself. He's working full-time, and he's sending like $200 every 2 weeks to the family of the guy who he killed. And it's like one of those things where the guy who he killed was probably partly at fault. You know, one of those weird kind of situations. So Chi, when he finally tracks him down because he had a bumper sticker on his car, something like saying, my kid is, I don't know, the best kid at Crown Point Elementary School. And Chi talks to the kid and he says, you should tell your grandfather he should take off that sticker. And he gives him another bumper sticker, which says, I'm proud of my grandson Leo, or I don't know, something like that. So, yeah, I mean, it was a very clever little plot twist where things don't work out as you're thinking they will.
We're talking to Anne Hillerman. The book is called Tony Hillerman's Landscape on the Road with Chi and Leaphorn. I think a mystery is a wonderful vehicle for, although you never want to be didactic, and I don't think he necessarily was, but for bringing up not only the kind of cultural issues that you were just talking about, but also really major social issues like uranium poisoning.
Right. Right. He talks about that in several of his books, and also about the devastation that mining has done on the Navajo reservation. Alcoholism is a big problem on the reservation. I mean, as it is in society in general. But in several of his books, he has in one particular, there's an old Navajo guy, a Navajo cop has been killed, and she arrests this Navajo guy. He's drunk. He has a gun. And like a reader, you can't think, well, this can't be it. You know, this is like chapter 3. How can they have found the guy? So you, as a reader, you're thinking, no, there must be something else more complicated here. Well, no, the story's more complicated because of subplots and nuances. But it turns out, yeah, that is the guy. And in the last chapter, he talks to the judge and he says, yeah, alcohol has ruined me. And I'm glad to be arrested because my life has just been a living hell. And I thought it was. It's not too preachy, but I thought it was clever, and it gets the point across very well.
It's funny that in a mystery, when something happens that's obvious, you think it can't be true. Whereas in life, when something happens that's obvious, you know it's true.
Yeah, that's right. We're also used to the conventions of mystery.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So in the book, the photographs are not just of landscapes. There are some cultural elements too. For example, rug auctions and fetishes and things like that.
Right, right. Don and I had such a good time going to the Crown Point rug auction. Our dad uses the rug auction in several of his books, and it's a wonderful place for people who are interested in not only in Navajo weaving but in Navajo culture. The weavers come. A lot of them, of course, are in their 70s and 80s because it takes a long time to weave a rug, and the pay isn't very much. Anyway, they come with their rugs and their children and their grandchildren, and some of the older ones don't speak English, but their kids and their grandkids all do, and they're happy. Usually, if the grandmother is a weaver, chances are her daughter might be a weaver too, and they love nothing better than to explain to you who they are, where they're from, what the rug is about. They usually have viewing for about an hour. Crown Point is a little bit north of Gallup, kind of between Gallup and Grants. It's easy for people to find it on a map, and they do the rug auctions there every month. Anyway, Don and I went to two or three of them, and every time it was just great. I mean, it's such a wonderful family event. And then there's, buyers who come from around the world too. People who are buying for shops, and then a lot of Europeans who just are crazy about the Native American stuff.
Right, which so many of them are, and it is funny how some European education contains kind of more true stories about what happened in the West than we have here.
Yeah, Don and I were so amazed when we were at the Grand Canyon. I bet 80% of the people we met were not Americans.
Yeah, Germans. Yeah.
Germans, Italians. We saw an Italian Harley club.
Wow.
Yeah, they had all their Harleys in vans, and they would ride them around the Grand Canyon, and the van would take them somewhere else, and they'd ride them around there. They were great. And lots of Japanese.
Very interesting. Were they readers? Did you find some of them who were readers of your father's mysteries translated into their languages?
I don't know, because I didn't really have a chance to talk to them. But I was amazed. All the bookstores there had a whole, row after row of Dad's books. I didn't notice that any of them had them translated, which they really ought to, since it's such an international destination.
Yeah, there's some German translations of Tony Hillerman mysteries.
Yeah, German.
Italian.
I think 35 languages.
Very interesting. The foreword of the book is by the president of the Navajo Nation, Joe Shirley, and I guess he and your father were friends.
Well, maybe not exactly friends, but professional associates. A group called Notable New Mexicans honored my dad about 5 years ago, and they invited Joe Shirley and his wife and his kids to come to that event, and I think that might have been the first time that they actually met.
Interesting.
But Joe Shirley had read Dad's books. His background was in sociology, and before he became a politician, so I think he probably had particular affection for them. And when Don and I were first starting our travels, we thought, well, do we need to get permission from the Navajo government to do any of this? So we contacted President Shirley. And actually, we didn't need permission for anything except a few, like Monument Valley, a few parks on the Navajo reservation. But he was just very, very welcoming of us. And we asked him if he would be willing to write that forward. And yeah, he said, sure, I would love to. And there it was. I think he did a good job on it, too. It's basically an invitation to people who like our book to come and see the Navajo Nation for themselves.
Which I thought was a beautiful thing. He said, I hope you come to find a culture, a way of life, and a people in the story told through the landscape depicted in this book. Better yet, I invite you to come and see us on our sacred lands.
Yeah, yeah. I thought that was really dear.
Indeed.
Yeah.
So you were doing this presentation at the Santa Fe Community Convention Center this coming Sunday, November 8th, from 4 to 6 in the afternoon. People can call the Lenzic box office at 988-1234. For more information, for tickets and so on, and the proceeds go to the Friends of the Santa Fe Public Library.
And not only that, the Friends of the Library are making bizcochitos. They'll have apple cider afterwards, And I think it's going to be a lot of fun. Billy Blair is going to be the mistress of ceremonies. Michael McGarrity, who a lot of people know as a Santa Fe author, is going to come and say a few words about why libraries are important, not only to authors, but just, you know, to everybody, why we need to support our libraries. And then we're going to have a surprise celebrity who's going to read Dad's quotes for us.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun.
So you have to go to find out who that is.
That's right.
Now, your father was also a great fan of libraries.
Indeed he was. Because he grew up in such a small little town, libraries were really his lifeline to the bigger world. Back when he was growing up, back in the 20s and 30s, there were a lot of books by mail. So he had an older brother and an older sister, and they would write in for whatever books they wanted, and then the books would come by mail. And instead of getting the Bobbsey twins or the Hardy Boys, they would get the history of geology in Oklahoma or esoteric things. But they always read them because there they were, books.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And it is interesting when you compare that time and a curious young mind to maybe the same curious young mind in a small town now who probably has access to cable.
Yeah, that's right. Cable and the bookmobiles.
And the bookmobiles, too. But a lot more, even in remote areas, a lot more mindless media, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, even on the Navajo Reservation, you see, discs for satellite TV. Yeah, so the world is changing really fast.
Anne Hillerman is the daughter of Tony Hillerman, and her new book is called Tony Hillerman's Landscape, On the Road with Chi and Leaphorn. And once again, Sunday, November 8th from 4 to 6 at the Convention Center. Thank you so much for being with us, and we're sorry we didn't have your husband, Don Strell, but the photographs in this book are absolutely beautiful. So we look forward to the presentation.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm very happy now to welcome Nan Elsasser. She is the producer of the theater production A Light in My Soul, Una Luz en Mi Alma, which is being produced this coming weekend at the James A. Little Theater here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for inviting me.
So this is a play about New Mexican crypto-Jews, or conversos, as they're called, and you developed, or the group, the Working Classroom Ensemble Company, developed this in the style of, and indeed in collaboration with, the Tectonic Theater Project.
Correct. We used exactly the same method that they used to develop the Laramie Project, which is to go out and interview people and edit the text down, transcribe everything, edit it down, and use people's real names and their actual words. So it's real stories from real people who live in New Mexico.
Were you yourself involved in these interviews?
Yes, I was. We spent about 2 years interviewing people, so I got to know a lot of the people, and I did more than half of the interviewing myself, so it was quite an experience.
How did you find the people, and how did you choose among the many possibilities in order to get the different kinds of voices?
Well, we began with people who had already gone public. Several people had already given interviews to New York Times and Time Magazine and the Albuquerque Journal. So we began with those people, and then they, slowly introduced us to other people. And our main commitment, our main search was to have all of the responses to this history represented. So we have people who are devout Catholic, who know and acknowledge this history in their families, but that it hasn't affected their religious choices. We have people who have become members of Jewish synagogues. We have people who are Messianic Jews. We have people who are agnostic, atheist. So we wanted, mostly in contrast to a lot of the work that's been done about conversos, not to push a particular agenda or point of view, but to really let this range of people speak about this incredible history.
So tell us about this incredible history. These are people who, for the most part, their first identity was Catholic.
Well, these are people that were forced to convert during the Inquisition in Spain, and then came to the, obviously the choices were limited. You converted or you were killed or you left. So, of course, a lot of the people who came to the New World had this background. Some few families, including one of the people that we interviewed, knew about it and actively practiced in private during this whole 500-600 years. Other people have discovered these roots recently. other people have these practices and that are just sort of family culture now. They're not really Jewish, but they're remnants of that culture in Spain.
And that's, I think, a common story that I've heard on more than one occasion, people doing certain rituals, either day of the week rituals or when somebody dies and so on, that they discover that their family's been doing for generations, if not hundreds of years, and then they discover those are Jewish traditions.
Right. Most prominent among them, lighting candles on Friday night, covering a mirror when someone dies, and of course not eating pork. There's so many families that, and we actually have one of the great quotes in the play is somebody who said, "Yeah, we used to eat pork, but somebody got sick, so we just decided not to eat it." So you know, there are all these vestiges of Jewish practices that still are quite pervasive in northern New Mexico. And then there's, you know, a lot of people who have discovered, you know, made bigger connections from this, and it's sort of, you know, been a tectonic shift in their life.
Tectonic theater
company and a tectonic
shift. Interesting. One of the themes that comes up in the play is just fear.
Yes.
Fear of the Inquisition, fear of ostracism, fear of just something as simple as being made fun of if you're a kid, that comes up in a, especially in a homogenous, or I don't even know how homogenous New Mexico really was, but compared to today, homogenous Roman Catholic
community. Definitely. I mean, there's fear for so many reasons that in terms of the stories that we've been told. One is, I don't think a lot of people know that the Inquisition was on the books in New Mexico well after the Civil War. So great-grandparents, you know, was not enforced. I mean, they weren't burning people at the stakes in the 1800s. But that was a very much, that kind of mindset was still very much alive until very recently in New Mexican history. There's also fear, obviously, if you're raised in a small Catholic community, not only the religion, there was very little and still is very little separation between religious life and cultural life. So if you reject Catholic religion, you're rejecting quinceañeras and Navidad and Matanz, I mean, everything that goes with that, being part of that community. There was also a lot of anti-Semitism in small Catholic communities here until fairly recently. So kids, you know, there was what you call being teased. I mean, and also hearing that the Jews killed Christ in church and then knowing that, wow, that was me, that was my family, that was my people. So there was that kind of fear of your own identity. And then there's just the fear of, you know, as one of the people in the play that says, if you come out and say you're Jewish, basically you say you've been lying, your grandparents have been lying, your whole family has been lying for 500 years. And so there's a lot of pressure not to rock the boat and make that kind of a public stand, because, you know, the question is, why do it? You know, why do it?
And so why have people done it? It seems like a very recent phenomenon. I've been here less than 20 years, and there's been a huge shift in people talking about it since I got here.
Yes, I think, you know, there is much more diversity in terms of the population of New Mexico, much more, I mean, the internet has changed so much. The DNA research is fascinating. People, all kinds of people are getting their DNA tested and finding out, you know, that their background is very far from what they assumed it was. So I think there's a lot more tolerance, a lot more intellectual inquiry, you know, a lot more inquisitiveness, and a feeling, you know, a feeling of more safety. And then as each time somebody does it, it's a little safer for the next person to do it. So I think it is like a tidal wave now of people doing this family research and discovering these roots and then deciding what, if anything, to do about it, what it means to them or doesn't mean to them.
And that's a big question of what identity is. If I found out that my great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparents were Buddhist or something like that, what difference would it make?
Right. Well, you know, that's a question I've asked over and over again, because the repercussions seem so profound. And I think it's from, you know, some of the conversations I've had, it's because this huge, horrible event has never been processed. And so people have been carrying, it's like incest in a family. They've been carrying this secret, unable to divulge it. and all of the repercussions that has on family life for centuries. And I think that's what makes it so such a heavy kind of thing. I mean, because I've said exactly the same thing. Well, if I knew I had a relative in China 500 years ago, I don't really think it would, you know, it wouldn't even make me want to go to China. I mean, it wouldn't have any effect on me. But one of the things that I've heard over and over and is that, you know, U.S. history is basically Anglo-Western European history. And so the Inquisition is basically, you know, Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492. So the people who suffered this trauma, this huge trauma, it's never been recognized. You know, there's no Holocaust literature. There's no Holocaust films. There's no telling of this story. Ashkenazi Jews, which are the majority of Jews in the United States, don't know anything about this. Basically, I think it's this abscess that's just grown and grown and grown and grown, and no one has recognized it. No one has helped people process it. So I think that is why it becomes such a volcano. Once people decide to, you know, look down the crater, it's like explodes.
We're talking to Nan Elsasser, producer of A Light in My Soul, Una Luz en Mi Alma, which is a theater piece that's opening this weekend, November 6th and 7th, 6th, 7th, and 8th, actually, at the James A. Little Theater here in Santa Fe. There are some people in the play who got their DNA tested. Right. And it does bring up this sort of odd question of, is religion in your DNA? Because race and religion aren't the same thing.
Right, and it's very complicated because what you get are Semitic markers. And so, you know, I'm not an expert by any, you know, I don't know anything about genetics and DNA testing and what it really tells you or doesn't tell you. But people are doing it, and they are finding, some people are finding that at least their history goes back to the Middle East, North Africa. Now, you know, what that means, it's open to debate, because that whole area was basically this mix of Muslim, Catholic, Jewish populations, and I don't know. Myself, I can't say, because I have no idea of if those are different genetic markers, you know, if you can tell the difference between one and the other. But it's pretty soon you will be. I mean, it's quite fascinating as like a whole new science and people finding that. And of course, we have this one great conversation in the play between a mother and a son, and the mother has returned to become part of a synagogue, and the son is a New York hipster. Has a food columnist and very skeptical, very New York, even though he's from New Mexico. And, you know, his thing is, you know, everybody wants to be the Cherokee princess or the Hebrew priest, the Kohanim, but, you know, nobody does research to prove that, you know, they were the prostitutes. You know, great-great-great-grandson. And so we all have this interest in creating a very elevated history. So it's very, you know, I personally just go and accept what people tell me. I mean, I think that some people have very compelling stories and evidence. Some people, you know, it's just maybe a choice they want to make. But I think that it's not, it's a heavy decision. I mean, it has consequences. And so I think most
the decision
to be cut, to say that you're converso, or to, you know, to come out as converso. So I assume that anybody who does that, they have some real reason to do it.
It is very interesting. Some of the people in the play, said that when they were young, when they were in school, they would go to church, but they didn't really resonate. Right. And I found myself thinking, well, there's a lot of people who were Catholic since the beginning of, right, since the year zero, who for whom it doesn't resonate. Right. And it's just so tricky to assign meaning to any particular thing. There's a lot of Jews who become Buddhists because, right, Judaism doesn't resonate.
Right, right, right. And, you know, I mean, there's certainly plenty of evidence. I mean, it's undeniable that a large number or a large percent of Spaniards who came to the New World had that background. And so, you know, how you decide which individual has it, I certainly wouldn't hazard a guess.
Right.
You know, we do have one person that we interviewed whose family, you know, actually practiced in an unbroken line in the closet, you know, for an entire 500, 600 years.
Which is amazing.
Yes, he has, you know, candlesticks from the 1400s and a prayer book and, I mean, all of this. And so, I don't know, you know, I mean, it's just, it's to me, I think New Mexico is an amazing place in the United States because it has so many histories. It doesn't have a single history. And it has competing histories, competing narratives of histories. So to me, this is another piece of that puzzle, another fascinating piece. I always think, you know, I'm not a novelist, but if I could write fiction, I'd try to figure out how did those conversos, including possibly Juan de Anate, now I saw in the New Mexican last week, they arrived here having just been forced to convert and then forced the Zunis to do the same thing, carrying that at that time, knowing it. I mean, it was lost, but they knew it then. And what that, you know, what psychologically that does to you as a person.
And as we know from innumerable examples from history and the present, when somebody oppresses you in some way and then you go along and oppress the next person, it can be really vicious.
Right. I mean, you have to prove that you are part of the majority at any cost, because that's how you survive. And that's, you know, this is a very specific example, but it's definitely part of U.S. history and probably human history. I mean, world history and not just U.S. history.
So. One of the things that I was thinking about while reading the play is there are so many ways in which religions are functionally identical. So one person has the mezuzah and another person has the patron saint of the guardian of the house. They are functionally the same. They've got different names. And it really shows the absurdity of intolerance because everybody's religions serve very similar needs.
Right. But, you know, religious intolerance has been one of the main themes of human history and it hasn't changed. I mean, you know, if you look at Iraq and Afghanistan and the U.S., where intolerance seems to be rearing its ugly head in pretty frightening ways right now. But it's definitely, you know, it does cause, even for the people who, in the play, you know, family members stop speaking to you. It causes these huge breaks in families, and it's just not okay to be a different religion.
Yeah. Well, we hope that the play sheds some light on the. I don't know. I read it and I think that's just such nonsense when people do that to each other, but they do it. What was your own interest? How did you get involved in all of this yourself?
I am the founder of Working Classroom. Last year was our 20th anniversary. And the company and the organization is predominantly Hispanic. I'm Jewish. And so this, in part, I had been reading some about this and thought, well, this is just an incredibly dramatic subject in itself. And secondly, what a great theme to bring, you know, in some way my culture and history, although I'm not Sephardic, together with the rest of the theater company. So that was the initial impetus. The other thing that was an impetus was that we had written a play with a playwright about a land grant struggle in New Mexico 5 years previous to that, and we found that New Mexicans, the turnout and the response was overwhelming, and we realized that New Mexicans are so hungry for theater that's really very specifically about New Mexico, that it's not enough to say you do Latino theater or multicultural theater or any of those terms that people, you know, that New Mexico is still so invisible in national artistic conversations, and people are just hungry for work that explores their histories and cultures. So after that play, we made a commitment that we would continue to work with playwrights and create work about New Mexico. So this was the second of the series.
The play is called A Light in My Soul, Una Luz in Mi Alma, and it is happening this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, November 6th and 7th at 7 o'clock, and then Sunday, November 8th at 2 o'clock in the afternoon at the James A. Little Theater. You can get tickets at the Lenzic box office. The number is 505-988-1234. Nan Elsasser is the producer, and I want to thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk about the play.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. We are podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. You can hear the show there anytime, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Experience.